It is springtime for coffee lovers.
Springtime for coffee lovers and Beverly.
And if you love coffee, you know that the secret to making the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans. But most coffees that you get at the grocery store or your local cafe could have been roasted up to months before they got to you. Which is why it's time to switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that they deliver this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or take advantage of their autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug is offering Top 100 listeners 10% off at checkout if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word. The offer applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? The time has never been better to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Go to sparkplugcoffee.com, and I promise 25,000% satisfaction.
Winter for cola and wine.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, movie moguls, and our deepest thank yous for giving the next 127 project a go. Our years-long odyssey to review the AFI's 123 classics was finished over 30 months ago. So now we check out various flicks, often true classics. And we spoil them from their nose to their toes. I'm the neurotic numbers man with the blue blanket who's hysterical, Ryan Ellis, and here's the cardboard-belted con woman, my incredibly guilty wife, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Springtime for Hitler, which is what this should have been called. They were never going to get to call it that. The studio wouldn't allow that, but that's what it should have been. The Producers is a pretty good title, but Springtime for Hitler, that would be remembered forever. Okay, so Gene Wilder made a lot of movies with Mel Brooks as his director and Richard Pryor as his co-star. So did Wilder make more movies with Brooks or with Pryor?
I forgot the question, so I didn't look it up when I was doing my research. So I'm just going to take a guess and say it was Pryor.
You're right, by one.
By one.
3-4. It was 3 with Brooks, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein were both in 74. Obviously, The Producers was the third one. I didn't write the Pryor titles down, but the most famous one is Silver Streak, and they did 4 together. All right, so Pryor won that little mini contest. The Producers was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. No dice, obviously, or else we wouldn't be talking about it right now. It was released 50 years ago, almost to the day, on November 10th, 1968, although it premiered a year earlier in Pittsburgh. And it didn't get a full release for all that time. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the podcast. It was a bit of a break-evener, not really a hit, not really a failure. Although the storyline is all about failing, so Bev, explain the storyline to people with the skinny.
Zero Mostel is corrupt and failing Broadway producer Max Bialystok, and Gene Wilder is his nervous accountant and conspirator, Leo Bloom. Together, they plot to oversell shares in a terrible play and keep all the investments when it inevitably flops. Only their best-laid plans are laid to waste when the play is so bad, it's great.
The concept of this movie was based on someone that Mel Brooks actually knew. I was reading. Someone actually did this kind of stuff with, was it movies? Let me just double check. Either movies or plays. Theatrical producer, so I guess we mean on The Great White Way. I don't know how long it worked for him. It couldn't work for too many years, I wouldn't think. Or, in a nutshell, I always knew Hitler was hilarious. He's so funny. Actually, that is the funniest part of the movie, is when we see them in the rehearsals, well, when they're auditioning all those Hitlers, and then the actual play itself. Okay, the numbers on The Producers. 90% of critics like the movie, 9-0. 62 fresh, 7 rotten, and 85% of audiences. The Matthew Broderick Nathan Lane remake in 2005, not so good, 50% and 65%. I thought it might even be worse than that. I remember that movie was torched by a lot of people. I didn't like it. I don't think Matthew Broderick was anywhere near as good as Gene Wilder in the exact same role with some, well, I guess all the same lines. I don't know why it didn't work, because he's a talented guy. It was a musical, of course, a musical on Broadway. I think that Nathan Lane did a pretty good job with Bialystok, but I don't feel like Broderick nailed Wilder at all. Maybe not many people can do Wilder. Look at Willy Wonka, Johnny Depp. People still torch that performance, and yet people rave even more than they did at the time about Wilder as Willy Wonka.
Yeah, he was unique in his way. You kind of have to look at the Broderick performance as something completely different, I think.
But it's supposed to be the same thing, except for the singing, so it shouldn't be different. So 1968, the year of producers, was also the year of 2001 A Space Odyssey, Rosemary's Baby, which we just recently covered, also set in New York, Planet of the Apes, which we covered a long time ago, Night of the Living Dead, which we covered even longer ago than that. They all succeeded pretty well, and all those podcasts are in our archives. But forget all those films, unless we want to compare them later, I guess. What did you think of The Producer, Springtime for Hitler?
Well, it vacillates between being the most brilliant comedy I've ever seen to an utter and embarrassing failure, sometimes in one scene.
Okay.
There are jokes that fall so flat, I'm not even sure what was meant to have been funny about them. But then there's Springtime for Hitler, mm-hmm. the play within the film, which is hysterical. That song, it is mind-bendingly funny. I have to assume that the esteem this film holds is a function of strictly selective memory. And I'm actually going to say that the bad parts outweigh the good parts for me, and this is a thumbs down.
Give me an example of a joke that falls flat for you this badly, because I will agree that there are big stretches where you don't laugh, and it's a disappointment because I've always liked this movie, but seeing it this time, I'm thinking, I don't think Bevis is into this because I didn't hear you laughing, but I wasn't laughing a lot too. The stuff you're supposed to laugh at, especially the play at the end, yes. But all the way through, and it's a short movie, it's only an hour and a half long.
You can be funny when you're just being amusing. Almost consistently through the whole film, I hated Zero Mostel. Yeah, I thought he was unwatchable. I don't just not find him funny. I found him painful to watch, even painful to look at, because they make him so aggressively unattractive. Hmm. And then his performance is such overkill that I felt embarrassed for him. Because it was falling, for me, it was falling so flat. I mean, obviously, a lot of people disagree with me, but every scene he was in was a failure. Every joke that he made.
What about Wilder?
Liked Wilder better. Found him, at the very least, more watchable. And then there were times where I was like, if this film just had more competent directing, definitely better timing. The comic timing, like the editing in this film, is so off. It's so slow. It's so slowly paced. Jokes go on for way too long. And there were a lot of his scenes where I'm like, that's salvageable. That could have been funny. Definitely not him. Never editing. Him. No, okay. But Gene Wilder, definitely. I thought there was a lot of stuff that he did where I was like, oh, yeah. There's a performance in there. It's just not really being handled adeptly enough to get the most out of it.
This was Brooks's debut. Of course, he's best known for, well, maybe this, but definitely Blazing Saddles. Not my favorite of his films. I prefer Young Frankenstein. I think that movie's hysterical the whole way through. Great performances. Wilder as Frankenstein. And you mentioned the editing. Ralph Rosenblum, who cut Annie Hall. We talked about that years ago. That movie was saved from being a murder mystery. Not saved, but changed from being a murder mystery in post-production. And it's a classic of romantic comedy now, which is not what they shot. And somehow he and Woody Allen made that work so differently. He worked with Woody Allen a lot through Woody's career, in fact. And Sidney Lumet early in their careers. But there's a great editor, and he didn't save this movie.
They fought in post-production.
Rosenblum and Brooks.
Mel Brooks apparently fought with everybody on this production. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably there's the case of a lot of people wanting to step over him because he was a newbie, didn't know what he was doing, and that apparently became pretty evident when they were on set, that he just really didn't know how to direct a film. He would have temper tantrums and yell at people, but still always insist on getting his way. But he also carried that fight over to the edit suite. What were you fighting for? What were you fighting this guy for? Because the timing is bizarrely terrible.
And as I said, it's a short movie. It's not like it's an hour and 45 minutes long. He wanted it to be tighter. If you make it much tighter, it wouldn't be a feature-length film.
Well, if I had my way with this film, it would probably be 40 minutes long. And I wouldn't even necessarily be cutting gags out, but I would be making them much shorter. It's amusing once, but when you have to drag it out, a five-second gag for 30 seconds, a good example I think of is when Gene Wilder and Mostel are fighting on the floor and they first meet in his office, mm-hmm. and at some point Wilder's on the floor and he says, don't jump on me, don't jump on me. If they just left it that, I feel like that would be funny. But then he had to have this thing where I was always afraid that somebody would jump on me. And it goes on and on. There's this whole explanation that just ruins the jokes. A lot of caveats in my complaints here, but it ruins the joke completely, overkills it. Speaking of comic timing and what an editor could do with this film, Springtime for Hitler, the funniest thing. Standalone, it is one of the funniest things in cinema. I wonder if part of the reason that that works, where so many things in the rest of the film don't work as well, is that the music itself forces a certain level of consistent timing, and you have to be a little more economical with your writing and your jokes, because it's always going to keep moving. It's a song.
You wouldn't like hearing then that the movie won the Best Original Screenplay Oscar for Mel Brooks.
Yeah, I sure wouldn't. I sure wouldn't like hearing that at all. I saw that when I was doing my research. I can't believe it.
And also the movie was 11th on the top 100 laughs list.
Oh my god.
Mel had 3 in the top 15, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, and The Producers. Some Like It Hot was number 1 on that list, by the way. Young Frankenstein is the best of all those movies to me, although I like Some Like It Hot more as the years have gone on. I don't think it's the funniest movie of all time, and I don't know if I'd put Producers in the top 11 anymore, although I think at one time I would have done that. The minute the line is said, "Will the dancing Hitlers please wait in the wings? We're only seeing singing Hitlers." From that point on, because that is the audition scene for all the Hitlers, the movie works. Then again, you know what? I'd forgotten all about the very end of this film. Just like Bond villains, these guys leave before the job is done. Let's go across the street and have a drink as our play fails. And then, what, 2 minutes later, everyone's starting to laugh at what's going on stage. Because LSD comes out as Hitler, and he ruins it by being funny. He's not good, but he is funny. The part I'd forgotten was even after that scene, when, of course, the play succeeds and these guys are sunk. Now they owe all this money. People that have thousands of shares in this thing in total. But then they try to blow up the theater with Franz Liebknecht, and they end up in jail. I remember them ending up in jail, but I didn't remember the whole blowing up the theater thing. Probably could have been cut, although that's how Franz gets put in jail too, because otherwise he wouldn't be going to jail. By the way, I have some reasonably good questions, just two. One of them involves Franz. Neither he nor Roger, the director, Mr. Belvedere, Christopher Hewitt, ever questioned the hilarity of this in rehearsals. The writer and the director never realized this isn't really working as a drama, which they think it is, or they should at least think it is. Are they too dumb?
Well, I wonder why nobody seems to call out the film for its blatant racism. The reason it's going to fail automatically, or should fail automatically, is because it's praising Hitler and this kind of Valentine to Adolf Hitler. Nobody questions that, but I wonder if that's a criticism on Mel Brooks' part of the theater in general, because he did come from the theater world.
And ended up back there by making this on Broadway and making so much money.
Oh my god, I know, so true. He must have met people and known people who would do anything for a job. Actors that would be like, what's the part? Singing, dancing, Hitler? Okay, whatever, I'll start stretching and me mamo. You know, they'll just do it because they want a gig so badly and they don't really overthink it.
Kudos to all the extras in the audience for their gape mouth performances. There's a few guys especially, but all the actors that are in those scenes. Some of them have dialogue, but effectively they're just speechless actors. Extras, I should say. And they are really good. But another reasonably good question. Why does the audience pay for tickets to a play called Springtime for Hitler?
What is it they say in New Yorkers? They'll go to the opening of an envelope? I think.
Oh, I never thought of that. Yeah, all these people are losers that couldn't get onto a real show back then. So
you tell somebody it's like a preview or just that it's opening night, they just want to be there to say that they were there.
That's a good answer to my reasonably good question. So back to the beginning of the film, which is obviously not something that works for you because there's so much Max in it. First, he's with all the women that he's been conning before. Although in that case, he's not doing anything illegal. He's doing something immoral because he's maybe having sex with them, maybe not, but he's taken their money before. And then, of course, when the ploy gets going, then he's really scamming them. But he's either a freak of sexual nature or was in deep need of Viagra back in those days, if he's actually having sex with them. I don't think he's actually having sex with Hold Me, Touch Me. Well, maybe her. But the one in the park who can't hear him. What? I love you. What?
That was one of the jokes that actually made me feel really squeamish and uncomfortable. I am going to talk about the things in this film that have not aged well, homophobia being a big one.
Yeah, some gay panic going on, yeah.
Yeah, and the sexism, this treatment of his female characters. I really, honest to God, try not to be a scold. When we're talking about old films, I understand that times were different and standards were different, and I'm not interested in holding films from the 60s to 2018 standards.
And he's not a James Bond hero. He is a villain in this, before and after the ploy
yes,
with
but
Leo.
It's more like the way the female characters are written. There's only two real female characters in the film, and that's Hold Me, Touch Me, and Ula.
Right.
There's no one else with, like, a really meaty part. I know there's the actress who plays Ava Gardner, but those are the two women in the film, and you have Hold Me, Touch Me, the little old lady, reflecting on this tasteless gag of horny, stupid, elderly women. It's a target that's always felt uncomfortably cruel to me. Their entire personality traits seem to just boil down to rich, horny, and gullible. And the film treats them like they really just are these walking ATM machines that any man could get cash from, presumably, if they were just degenerate enough to sleep with an elderly woman.
Or even spend time with an
elderly woman. Or even
spend
time with them. And Max's disgust for these women is especially cruel, since he doesn't look that much younger than Miss Hold Me, Touch Me. And the production goes out of their way to make him unattractive. And then, of course, there's Ula, who is the dictionary definition of objectification. She has no agency. She follows orders, not even like a dog, more like a machine. She's not even smart enough to react to shots being fired in the next room. She just keeps dancing. She is not a person by any definition. She is a body, like a doll, and it's quite appropriate that Max calls her a toy. So maybe I wouldn't have found those jokes funny in 1967.
68, but okay.
68.
67 it first came out.
67 if I lived in Premier. Pittsburgh.
Yes.
But they just really make my skin crawl now, and I'm not trying to be a scold, but that doesn't mean I have to like it.
This movie, as Mel said, and Roger Ebert quoted him on this, I guess Ebert may have been with him when this was said, I think I read that somewhere. Some woman complained about the movie was vulgar, and he said, "Lady, it rose below vulgarity."
He's proud of his vulgarity, and that's fine.
He also said the only way to deal with Hitler is to mock him, which is fair. I remember Bill Maher said not long ago, "Hey, I'm going to compare Hitler to Trump." I don't mean it that way, but just a leader that is hard to deal with one way or another. And Maher said you need a comedian like Al Franken, the Minnesota senator who was disgraced in the Me Too scandals. His point was you need to mock people like this, not rise below their level or to their level. Laugh at them.
And maybe that's why Springtime for Hitler has aged so well, but other parts of the film have not, because you can make fun of Hitler. That's hysterical. You can make fun of this Nazi who wrote the script. That's punching up, in a way, or at least punching an appropriate target. Little old ladies, I don't know. Is that funny to make fun of them? How about homosexuals? The way his portrayal of queerness in this film is...
Hollywood cliche. Even until recently,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
true.
Yeah, and that's definitely like a 2018 view on a 1960s film.
I don't know when this really stopped, but I would say probably even 10 years ago, certainly 20
yeah,
years ago, you still
right.
would have seen the same kind of thing
at least,
in a Hollywood film.
At least Gay Panic was still like a very viable punchline.
It's kind of funny when the camera shows above, these three guys are crammed into an elevator together, but it also shows that they don't want to be there because, oh my God, our penises are almost touching. And then, of course, we meet Mr. Belvedere, well... Roger, right after that, and he's cross-dressing, and clearly the most uncomfortable person of the two of them is actually Leo.
Yeah.
Who, you could argue, maybe seems like a gay guy? I don't know. Is that really fair
but
to say?
He is kind of an effeminate.
Max doesn't seem like a gay guy, but Leo sort of does, a little bit anyway.
So last year, Mel Brooks did this interview with the LA Times that he got pilloried for a little bit because he was saying that, oh, extreme political correctness will destroy comedy. And I guess he's right in the way that, yes, if you let the outrage police completely have control, then yeah, it's going to be pretty hard to crack a joke about anything around here. But regular political correctness is kind of destroying the cheap, easy comedy that he indulged in. He was 90 when he said that, but it is interesting to see that the parts of his film that have aged best are the ones that punched up, and the ones that punched down are the ones that either you can intellectually understand how somebody enjoyed it once upon a time, or you're outright made very uncomfortable by it.
As far as the story goes and the whole plot line, when they try to scam people out of their money and then create a failure deliberately, it's a good thing Max whines about his failures to Leo, or there'd be no story. There'd be no story.
I just can't believe Leo, who's this anxious, is still...
It's really his idea.
And it actually is cute that he does the whole romancing him. Oh, you know what? That scene is kind of funny. Like, it went on for a long time. But I did actually like the bit where he romanced Leo the same way he romanced the little old ladies. And it was like a full montage of everything you see in a romance takes him on the boat.
I want everything I've ever seen in the movies. And the fountain goes off. But Max has only known Leo for mere minutes before they concoct the scheme. That's probably just a movie thing. And maybe this is one time where they did actually shorten things in the editing suite and didn't have them go on forever about it. I was reading Creative Accounting, which is a line that Leo uses. It was the first time that was ever said by anybody.
Oh, wow.
Maybe Mel Brooks came up with it. I don't know. Wilder did my second favorite scene in the whole movie after the whole Springtime for Hitler play, the wet and hysterical thing, while he was tired and got it in a few takes. Sometimes when you're tired, Dustin Hoffman said that on Midnight Cowboy, the whole scene where he's got soup and his hands rattling. I guess that came out of being exhausted and I can't do this scene. I don't know how to get my way into this scene. And the idea is play the exhaustion that you actually are feeling right now. And of course, Hoffman played exhaustion quite well in Marathon Man, where he stayed up for days. So that scene works anyway, and maybe it worked better because Wilder didn't have the energy. He has a lot of energy, but maybe he was doing it wrong. I don't know. And you mentioned that Brooks fought with people. He also fought with Mostel, and he and Wilder do have a, I don't know about love-hate relationship in their history together. It did, because they worked together so long ago. They definitely did on Young Frankenstein. We're going to cover that next year. And we'll talk about that, obviously, then. Brooks fought with Mostel an awful lot, but Mostel and Wilder really clicked. Maybe the idea being, here's a new actor. Wilder had been in one movie before this.
It was Bonnie and Clyde.
His first movie was Bonnie and Clyde, but he's also a little bit weird and kind of funny. Not a hilarious movie, but a bit of a funny scene. He's the Undertaker in that. So I think the opening bit, however long it lasts, when Leo comes into the picture at least, not so much the woman stuff at the very beginning, which isn't really all that funny, for your politically correct point you made, but also because I don't think it's all that funny, those sequences. But when Leo comes into the room, it is kind of funny. And then there's Franz Liebkind, who's not bad. Kenneth Mars was a committed actor. He was so committed to this role that Wilder thought he was serious and maybe didn't get the joke. He's also in Young Frankenstein. Mars is. He reminds me, though, in a serious way, of Nazis who escaped justice in reality here and lived free in America. And maybe in some cases, people in power knew that.
They probably knew better than to dress like they were still Nazis. Army fatigues and battle helmets.
And never stop talking about the Führer.
Yeah.
He has an AFI-nominated line. Not many people know it, but the Führer was a terrific dancer. Just kind of funny. But I prefer, where did I go right? Or the wet and hysterical speech. Just that whole thing. I'm hysterical, and I'm wet, and I'm in pain.
My favorite line of Kenneth Mars, when he's yelling in the theater and somebody tells him to shut up. I'm the writer. I outrank you.
Well, forget the part there. You're the audience. I'm the writer. I outrank you. Because he's sitting and watching and still not getting that this is funny. I know you don't like Ratatouille, but I got to quote Ratatouille here about him. Good or bad art can come from anywhere, as Peter O'Toole, the critic, says in that movie. The play is terrible, but had it been good, this guy came from Nazi Germany and has no obvious writing talents, but if he did, why not? A Nazi can be a good writer too, even though he's not.
It's kind of like the play is The Room a little bit. Tommy Wiseau is so terrible that he accidentally makes this perfectly unique, surprisingly watchable train wreck.
That people laugh at, and he claims now was always intended that way. No, it wasn't.
No,
Neither was Springtime for Hitler in the movie. Mel Brooks knows it's funny, but the people who made it, apart from the producers who are trying to steal from people, they have no idea, and I don't really know why, but I guess that's just the way it has to go. It is sweet how much these talentless people want to be in show business. Other movies have covered that kind of thing. That saves the movie for... I like the movie more than you did anyway. I'm definitely a thumb up, but not as much as I was the last time I saw the movie, whenever that was, years ago. There is a Busby Berkeley-type shot during the Springtime for Hitler thing showing the Nazi symbol. I heard you laugh out loud at that. That was a great idea. But then again, the theater audience can't even see it. So it's entirely just for us.
It's worth movie it, audience. Though.
And of course,
really
that's
funny.
Why it's there.
That song dance is so good.
Don't be stupid. Be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party. Mel Brooks does the voiceover for that
guy. With all the girls in their showgirl outfits that make no sense on any planet.
Obviously, those actors, and none of them are stars, then or now, the people that play the Nazis in the play. And this certainly applies to Mostel, Wilder, and the rest of the cast for that matter, too. But those people especially had energy. They were committed. You've talked about comedy as commitment. Were they terrified, though, this might ruin their careers? Because obviously they know it's supposed to be a comedy. The movie they're making, though, the people they're playing don't know that. But they're running the risk, too, because they're making this movie in Jewish Hollywood, even though it's made by a Jewish director and writer who was already known from the, 3,000-year-old man with Carl Reiner? Ooh, what's it called? I should know this. Anyway.
Oh, man, don't look at me.
They were known for that, and they also both wrote on Sid Caesar's Show of Shows before any of this.
And Mostel didn't want to do it, right?
He wasn't a movie actor. He, I guess, was on Broadway or something. He doesn't have that many credits on his list.
Might explain why he acts for the cheap seats, which was kind of my complaint.
He's loud, yeah.
He's loud. His gestures are all hysterical.
I remember thinking Nathan Lane was better than him in the 2005 one.
I believe
although,
it.
As I said before, I don't think Broderick was at all better than Wilder. Wilder only made 22 movies himself. He was obviously a movie actor, and I don't think he did Broadway stuff. If he did, it certainly wasn't as much as he did movies, and he only made 22 movies. As for Mars playing Franz Liebkin, well cast. Pretty funny, I would say, overall. Probably the third funniest thing in this movie. Well, you don't like Zero Mostel, so maybe you say the second funniest thing in this movie, actor-wise.
Actually, I think LSD is the second funniest thing
in this movie. Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Dick Shawn, he was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in 63 before that.
He does a great job of doing the overkill. Like, he's definitely matching the tone of the film where every gesture he makes is an exaggeration, and that's where the comedy comes from. But, I don't know, for some reason he just sells it better for me. I found him more watchable and funny.
If he hadn't come onto the stage as early as he does after the initial Springtime for Hitler number, if there'd been a little bit longer of some other actor, then everyone would have left, because they were all leaving, and suddenly they hear him and say, hey, that's funny, let's go check that out. But the Simpsons thing there, the fickle audience... Let's let him go! Fickle mob, I should say, not audience. But anyway, about Mars playing Liebkin, Dustin Hoffman was going to play that character, but he got The Graduate instead. And Dustin Hoffman's a great actor. We just talked about him last week on Wag the Dog. But I don't know. I think he got lucky with the bigger guy, the galoot, the unknown. Although Dustin Hoffman was unknown, too.
I know Dustin Hoffman. I totally see him in comedy. And I find him very funny when he does comedy, but yeah, I cannot picture him in this part at all. Or it would have just been a really dramatically different interpretation of the character.
Although he wasn't a star at the time, Hoffman obviously became one after this, and Kenneth Mars never was a star. And in comparison, you know who played the Ula character in the 2005 remake? Nicole Kidman.
What? No, it was Uma Thurman. What are you talking about?
Oh, geez, okay.
You're well,
still,
way off!
All right, well, still a big star compared to Lee Meredith, who played her in the 67-68 movie, I should say. And
at
Will Ferrell.
Point, they could have gotten any star they wanted to play any part for the right. producers.
Because Will Ferrell and Uma Thurman, okay, are probably bigger names overall than Broderick and Lane are in the two main roles.
And Broderick and Lane, we have to be clear, the Broadway play was a smash.
So they must have been good.
Like, it was a Hamilton-level, impossible-to-get-tickets, mm-hmm. absolutely the sensation of Broadway
award
for
winner too.
Years.
Think and
award
winner. Tony's.
So to get them, the two original guys from the Broadway cast, was definitely a get, and I don't think that would have helped the movie anything at all to recast those two parts in particular.
No.
I kind of want to watch it because I just want to see Will Ferrell do Kenneth Marx's part.
Mm-hmm. Movie's 185-1. We watched the DVD, and like most DVDs we've watched lately, Rosemary's Baby and The Birds and so on. Looked adequate at best, pretty soft. The cinematographer shooting it, Joseph Coffey, only shot three movies, but was an associate DP on Kramer vs. Kramer. So he's seen Dustin Hoffman in a movie. He didn't see him in this movie after all, but he did see him in Kramer vs. Kramer many years later.
I have no praise for the light or cinematography in
no,
the film.
No, it's just there.
It's very
most comedies,
studio-y.
You're supposed to see as many things in the set as you can. You're not going for anything dark or weird or mysterious. Then the music, the composer John Morris. This was his first movie. He made many with Mel, including Young Frankenstein. And he also did music on The Elephant Man, which Brooks produced, and Dirty Dancing. And I always ask you about the music, the cutting, and the cinematography. We talked about the editing already. Maybe it wasn't Rosenblum's fault, but what about the music? I don't even remember the music.
It kind
now.
Of blends, yeah.
I don't
it
know
must
Morris,
be good because you don't notice it.
I don't know how much involvement Morris had on the Springtime for Hitler musical section of this movie. If he did, then that deserves some kudos.
I think Brooks was credited with writing the lyrics for both of the songs. Well, Springtime for Hitler, the song that LSD sings, is it Prisoner of Love? Or is that
That's
the one they
the
do
end.
In the prison? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At the very end, yeah. How did Springtime for Hitler not get nominated for the Oscar?
If it won an Oscar for that, rather than the screenplay, oh my god, then that's one thing.
I was looking up the various nominees for the script category and the supporting actor category. Nobody really stood out. The actor who won for supporting actor was Jack Albertson, and the subject was Roses. The other screenplays didn't really stand out any more than this, so. Some influences, we talked about the Broadway musical, which was a smash, but the movie was a bomb. I don't really know why, I didn't like it that much, but I can't say anything about the Broadway musical because I haven't seen it. The same story was done before, not literally this being adapted, but the same kind of idea of bilking people out of money and then trying to have a failure, in New Faces of 1937 and Mr. 10%, which was only a year before this movie. So it was an original idea, but not entirely original. There's a line in the movie I pointed out to you when the film was going, I fell on my keys, which is also one of the best lines in Wayne's World, when another Nebuchadnezzar-type character, Garth, falls on his keys. I guess they stole that from this movie. It's the exact same line. Seinfeld. Also ended with the main characters performing in jail. Well, Jerry, at least, doing his act in jail. You can't keep him down. You want to end on a good note in both cases because these guys do go to jail. They're incredibly guilty. Peter Sellers saw this, raved about it, and that helped get it released because it probably was never going to go anywhere after that Pittsburgh premiere.
Peter Sellers had a part in the film and then walked away from it. They said that they gave him the part. It was either Leo Bloom or it was LSD.
Well, I could see him being Leo Bloom.
But I could see him being LSD too. Actually, I'm pretty sure it was Leo Bloom. They offered him the part, he accepted, and then he ghosted them. And they didn't know what happened, but then they showed him an early release of the film, and he loved it and praised it to everybody and kind of helped publicize it.
There's a funny story by Paul Mazursky on that because he was directing Sellers in something, I think is what it was, or was a friend around that time. He was going to show Sellers a print of The Vitelloni. For some reason, the movie didn't work. And this is back when he actually showed a film, you know, in a screening room kind of thing. Check us, they can do now, but you probably wouldn't. You'd show a DVD or Blu-ray or whatever. But because it didn't work, when it came up later on, a few weeks later, Sellers responded, no, the Vitelloni, no, I'm not going to watch that. No, that's horrible. They had this, played it. I don't think it was going to go anywhere. And when Sellers, who was a big player and had the stroke to say, get this movie out there. That's the story anyway. That's what they say on the making of. Makes you wonder if one actor can make that kind of thing happen, but I guess he can. Probably should be one of the producers on this movie called The Producers in the end because it wouldn't have existed, I don't think. Certainly not in a big way. Whether you liked it or not, whether I liked it or not, it is in the National Film Registry, which was in 1996. Jazz Singer, The Graduate, MASH, all made it that same year. All movies we had issues with as well, didn't we? In
yeah, big
another.
Time.
They're all AFI movies. The Awful Truth, which we covered last year, was put in that same year. Not so many issues with that. We definitely enjoyed that one an awful lot. Irene Dunne and Cary Grant. Springtime for Hitler was 80th on the top 100 songs. It should have been higher than that, I think. It could have been the top 50 or even the top 25. It's a great song. It's very singable. And talk about relevant to the movie. As I've said 1,000 times, usually this is the Oscar more than the songs on that list. But the one that wins the Oscar so often is a song that no one would ever associate with the film or played in the end credits when no one even heard the damn thing. But this one is in the movie and is vital to the whole deal. It's the name of the play. We talked about how it made the Top Nerd laughs in the 11th spot, and it was nominated for that quote, which I don't think was the best one. Like you say, I outrank you is an even better line. And so is, I hired the wrong cast, I hired the wrong director, all the... Where did I go right? Okay, last thoughts on the producers.
I just want to bring up the one review that helped me understand the appeal of the film, and that was Roger Ebert's Great Movies essay, mm-hmm. where he describes the liberating catharsis of watching something that was so radically vulgar and improper for the time. He compared it, and this is what helped me, to There's Something About Mary, which kind of helped because I suspect that future generations will watch Farrelly Brothers films and be just as perplexed about their appeal as I am perplexed about the appeal of the producers. But I loved There's Something About Mary. I'm a little reluctant to revisit it now in 2018, but at the time it was just so gutsy about its depravity, and there's something special about that abandon. So I think that's the closest I could come to kind of putting myself in the time and place and understanding what is actually special about the producers that I am obviously missing. But I'm sorry to say that, save for a handful of standout jokes and, of course, Springtime for Hitler, this movie was a real failure for me.
I found it funnier in previous views. There's those big gaps where we didn't laugh. But the high points are very high.
They really, really are.
So that definitely saves it. The actual play within the movie is hilarious. I think Wilder's really good. I didn't mind Mostel. I also just admire that they got this movie made in Hollywood. Although they are mocking the guys. Not like they're saying, Hitler's awesome, and they got a movie made about him.
Well, when you said you were surprised that Springtime for Hitler didn't do better on the songs list, I wonder if it's partially because when you take that song out of its context, it can seem bizarrely offensive. Mm. Anybody who hasn't seen the film will listen to that song and be like, this is terrible. So maybe that's why it just couldn't climb higher in the charts.
Yeah, the number one song on that list is Over the Rainbow and Wizard of Oz, which of course is a classic, and I'm not going to argue with that too much, but it's so serious. But Springtime for Hitler is so much fun. All right, well, that does it for the producers. Next week, we'll stay on this comedy kick we've established this November. It wasn't really planned that way, but that's the way it's working out. And we'll glance back at one of the best from Albert Brooks, which I know you like, Lost in America.
I love Lost in America.
It also made the laughs list, although nowhere near as high as the producers. It was in the 80s or something like that. So the coming attraction is trivia for Lost in America. When David and Linda abruptly leave Arizona and race to New York City at the end of the film, they pass through many states and one district. Name all the ones that are shown.
Oh my god. Okay, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Lost in America. But what if you just can't wait until then and you need more Ryan and Bev in your life? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. You also can check out our entire roster of podcasts that we've done. We've covered close to 275 movies.
Very close now.
Very close now. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange you could hit that subscribe button. And while you're there, give us a rating and a review. That means a lot to us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. And Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case-sensitive.
End time for podcasts, so take us out.
And cut.
I'm hysterical. I'm wet, and I'm in pain, and I'm still hysterical!